Viewers, listeners, welcome to another episode of Blighty Talks Bricks. Today's episode brings an end to season four. That means our 40th episode. I'm really happy to have my guest with me today, somebody I've known for a number of years. I think it would be right to call him Rugby Royalty. I think that would be a fair call. His career saw him play for a number of rugby clubs, starting back in the day at Barkin, a period at Saracens, and then a long career at Harlequins. He won 114 caps for his country, winning four Grand Slams. He played on three British Lions tours, but we probably all know him best for being a member of the England World Cup winning side in 2003 on that famous, I'm going to say morning, because I was back in the UK, but a famous evening in Sydney. He's also, in addition to all of those lovely things I've just said about, he's a top bloke. He's a lovely human being. I'm lucky to call him a friend. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Jason Leonard, OBE. Jason, welcome to Blighty Talks Bricks. How are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. Thank you.
It's good to see you.
And you?
You're looking well.
I'm all right at this moment in time. Yeah, thank you.
Been busy?
Yeah, always busy. You know that.
I want to touch on this. You're like me. We're a little bit further away from where you were born, but this is my manor, Shoreditch. You're a Barking boy. Fair to say, working class lad.
Yeah, I think everyone gets a little bit caught up about rugby sometimes because the public school influence over many, many years. I think that's going. Really, I think there's always going to be an element of it there because rugby is played in private schools. And dare I say, in more comprehensive schools that me and you would have been growing up in, is soccer. It's similar enough as that. But rugby is getting into these schools. But we're never going to take over from soccer. Soccer's just such a big monster of a sport in that regard, and kids want to play soccer. They love the sport and stuff like that, but also everyone wants to be the next David Beckham. They want to be the next Harry Kane and stuff like that. So in rugby, it's just less so. And we know our place. We're never going to brag and say that we're the number one sport in England and stuff like that. We're not. It's way out there. Soccer's streets ahead of us.
Talking about it, so Barking, did you know you were good at rugby? I mean, did it surprise you were good at rugby? Did you play football?
No, I played football at school, and most of my team were county players at that time, and I was there just to hack someone down if they got a one-on-one with a keeper. That's basically what I was there for, and I suppose to a certain degree, I played my football a little bit like rugby in that regard.
Grabbed them around the neck and started your way down.
Just take them out, sort of thing like that. And then all of a sudden, one term, a Welsh PE teacher turned up and we're all sitting in our football gear, sitting in the change rooms, and he basically says something along the lines of, I've just looked at the school sporting curriculum and I don't see rugby. You don't play any rugby.
That's come down to PE teachers and their preferences at times, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And we were quite smug in our answer. We were like, yeah, you're right, we don't. And he said something like, you will do next term. And that was it. And being a big kid and being a physical kid as well, I was always being told at school, Leonard, put him down. Don't do that. Do this, that, and the other.
So then put him down.
Yeah. Again, when you're a chunk of a kid in that aspect,
you were big as a kid.
I was big as a kid, and I was rough with it as well. And then you're always being told by the teachers, pack that in or don't do this and this. And then all of a sudden you play a game of rugby, and they're telling you the complete opposite.
Get
stuck in it. Get stuck into them. That's it. Tackle him. This, that, and the other, and all this. Yeah, so for me, it was a bit of a game changer where I enjoyed my football. I really did. But as I said, I was there for one reason in that aspect.
Yeah, but you're not just a stopper, are you? You played the game properly. You knew what you were doing. But did that develop later on, or was you just actually? Do you know what? I feel as though I know what's going on here.
I think as a kid, I wouldn't say it's exact, but I think I started playing when I was about 11, really. At 11 years of age, I weighed 11 stone. At 12, I weighed 12 stone. At 13, 13 stone.
It'll be interesting when you're 90, isn't it?
Well, I've got to say, I think I've hit the roof at this moment in time. I can't go any more than what I am at the moment. But I was just physically a big kid. And rugby for me, and I suppose for everyone who's played rugby, it's the values of rugby that make it so special. So you'd come off the football pitch, and whether you've played well or you played badly and stuff like that, and you're still part of a team. But as a rugby team, you are dependent on each other. I mean, so much so.
Yep.
And the backs can't score tries if the forwards ain't winning them the ball, sort of thing like that. There's the values in rugby where you leave everything on the pitch and it stays there. You don't walk off having a row with someone. You walk off shaking someone's hand.
Yep.
And I think as I started getting older, still playing football in that regard, I think normally in most boys and girls, if you're playing multiple sports, you get to an age where 14, 15, you've got to make a decision whether if you've got talent and you know that, or other people are telling you you've got talent, you've got to make a decision. You've got to move, maybe go to a bigger and better club, test yourself a little bit more, sort of thing like that. Sort of put yourself out there.
You've got to take the big fish out of that pool and and work your way again.
But there's nothing wrong if you're not that good. Then you just play with your mates locally and you're happy playing in the second and third teams. There's nothing wrong with that either in that regard. But I think when you get to that sort of 13, 14, 15, if you're playing two sports, three sports, you've got to pick one of them. If you want to make a decent fist of it, you've got to give it a go. Or you just say, look, I'm just an all right sports person and I'll play all of them, but I don't really care if I'm playing first team and all this. And I got a chance, as I said, at that age where kids were, teachers and coaches were saying, look, you're actually not a bad rugby player. Like, do you want to come and play at our club, sort of thing like that? And locally to me was Ilford Wanderers and Barking Rugby Club. And I had two school teachers, PE teachers, both bending my ear saying, come to my club, something like that. And I chose Barking in that regard. And I went there on a match. It was like I think because of the size of me, I always started young in that aspect. So I was playing in a under 16 side when I was about 14. Then you get moved up to the under 19s, what we call Colts.
Yep.
When I was 15, because again,
so really that at rugby, that's a big jump,
it's a big
isn't
jump.
It?
Yeah, and then the same, you're getting in the first team, stuff like that. So I suppose to a certain degree, it was a case of I found rugby, or rugby found me. But the happiest place for me to be at any one time was actually on the rugby field.
Was it?
Yeah.
And then you moved from Barking to Sarries for a year?
For 2 years, actually, two seasons. Had a great 2 years there. We were very much the sort of poor London club in that regard.
Yeah.
I know a few people watching this that know Saracens and go, oh, yeah. No, I most probably the only player that went to Saracens when they were skinned. They had no money when I went there.
Well, I remember because my PE teacher at Broxbourne School, having moved out of East London, was playing for Sarries, Steve Downing.
Yeah.
At the time. And as you say, they weren't what they are today, that's for sure.
Definitely not. But I loved it. Went there. We was in what would be the old second division at the time. And a number of players turned up. And Our coaching were good. We had good coaches at that time. And we won the second division unbeaten. So the following year, we're in the first division. It was the first time ever Saracens had been in what was the first division. And we had we made a decent fist of it as well. We got about halfway up the table. At one point, we was about third and fourth. But again, you get injuries and stuff like that, and other teams are getting into it. So, but as a first year in the Premiership, it was a great result for us as a club.
The move to Quinns was easy for you?
No, I went on tour with England, actually, when I was still at Saracens. So it would have been the summer of 1990. And I had no intention moving away from Saracens. We'd lost a player just the year before, Dean Ryan, fantastic number eight for Saracens, moved to Wasps. Played for England on my first match as well. That was his debut as well. So the club didn't want to lose me, but in it was just a mixture of things like El Maelstrom, and in that aspect, that when I got back, I popped down a club and this and the other, and the first team coach was away, the second team coach was away, the third team coach took practice, and it just wasn't a great session.
What you needed. Yeah.
And this guy obviously didn't know who I was, and we ended up doing a scrummaging session, and it was a terrible session. It was useless. And Southgate at that time, where literally Saris were playing, the park, the council park, would either be rock hard in the summer, which it was, or it'd be a foot of mud in the winter. So, as I said, I went back there, and I didn't need to go back. This is most probably the thing. I didn't need to go back, but I wanted to see the lads and all this. So I ended up doing a training session, and we couldn't scrummage properly because, obviously, it was like scrummaging on concrete, so you couldn't get no grip. So every scrum's collapsing, and then it's causing punch-ups and rats and all this. So the coach, and I'm saying to this coach, I'm saying, look, mate, this is ridiculous. Like, just bin it off. He's going, no. I said, look, you can't get no purchase, can't get no grip because of the studs. He goes, right, everyone, go and get your trainers and come back and we'll do it in trainers. I'm like, are you an idiot? Because you're not going to get any,
any traction there.
So the same thing happened again, and there was collapsed scrums and punch-ups and all this. And in the end, I sort of said to this bloke, it's daft, it's stupid. And then he basically said to me, he said something along the lines of, it's you, it's your grip, it's your bind. And I went, sorry, what? And he said, it's your bind. I went, like, tell me, how's it my bind? And he went, no, your bind's here and it should be up there and all this. And I went, mate, and I said, I've just come back from Argentina. I've played with two of the best front rowers in the world, as in Brian Moore and Jeff Probyn. And if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for you. Yeah. And to a certain degree, I flounced at the club, like having a real diva. I was having a real diva moment in that aspect. And of course, Harlequins, at that moment in time, there was a great prop called Paul Curtis, Welsh lad, marrying his fiance, going back down to Wales. So they had a spot at Loosehead, and their pack at the time was a fantastic pack. You had Brian Moore, a hooker. You had Andy Mullins at tight end. You had Paul Ackford, long time England and Lions.
Policeman,
yeah. You had Troy Coker, Australian number eight, World Cup winning number eight. You had a back row of Winterbottom and Skinner to England.
It's becoming a bit
legends.
Of a no-brainer, isn't it?
And the number eight was a guy who played for England who was a crazy, fantastic, hard as nails guy called Chris Butcher. Yep. And he played on the 84 tour of South Africa. So basically, the options were stay at Saris and learn my trade, but most probably might get a cap in 6, 7, 8 years, another cap, if you know what I mean. Or go to Quinns. I'm playing Paul Ackford, the England second row behind me, and I've got Winterbottom and Skinner. So you're there going, it is a no-brainer.
I used to go and watch it at that time. So
yeah, so that's all it was. It was a case of development, my development. I wanted to learn my trade, and to a certain degree, Saris, and they were desperate to keep me, which is very, very kind of them. And basically they're saying, look, and we had a fantastic captain at Saracens at the time, Floyd Steadman, and he come round and a couple of the other guys come round to my place and try to talk me out of it. And they're saying, look, you'll be a captain. Look, Floyd ain't going to be around much longer. You'll be a captain. We make you vice captain and all this. I'm going, I don't want to be vice captain. I'm literally 21 years of age. Why do I want to be
vice captain? Building my knowledge and playing. I want to play at the highest level.
I just want to learn. I want to be like a sponge, sort of thing like that. So that was the reason why. And then basically, I think that year, 2 years with those sort of players at Harlequins was like a fast track for me in that regard.
Great decision, 114 caps later. At the time you got your 114th, you were the world record holder at Test caps. I'm telling you stuff you know. I want to come back to England, but it's a question I've got for you. The British Lions. I'm a royalist, so I love the UK. We join up with Ireland. What I struggle when I love it when the Lions play. I've never been on a tour, but I want to go. You guys knock shit out of each other. Every January, February, March, drifts, Six Nations now. I've seen you have tear-ups. I've seen all sorts. I've seen sort of claret everywhere. Every 4 years, the Lions Tour comes around, and you're like a band of brothers. What do? Do they inject you with something to cuddle each other and love each other? How can you go from that sublime? Because when you go on that tour, it's brutal, isn't it? Physically.
Yeah, I don't think... People don't understand really how hard and fast it is, because it basically is Wednesday, Saturday for the best part of 6 weeks. Yeah. So it's ferocious. Back in the day, they used to make you travel by bus. So it used to take even more time out of your diary. So you spend even less time on the training fields, sort of thing like that. Nowadays, it's much better. You fly and stuff like that. But... it is a tough one. I know what you mean. It does seem a bit crazy that you spend sort of 4 years knocking lumps out of each other.
Absolutely.
And then you come together. I suppose to a certain degree, you need good people. So for a Lions Tour to be successful, and every Lions Tour should, if you look at it in the clear light of day, the Lions should never, ever win, because everything is stacked against you.
Yep.
You're travelling down to Australia, New Zealand or South Africa.
Yep.
Three of the best teams in the world.
Yep.
South Africa's not too bad. It's still a 12-hour flight, but you're roughly in the same time zone.
That's one thing in your favour.
The other two, you're out of whack for a few days, sort of thing like that. But you're expected to hit the ground running, and you're training, you're playing. And you're their supporting teammates. That, again, as you said, these are not the guys I normally play with and support and stuff like that.
Broken your nose or chewed your ear off at some point.
But again, you need, it's a selection. You need good people there that can get past, that can get over something like that. And it's about the whole. And then that includes the coaches, that includes... The staff and stuff like that. It's a real team effort, because if you think about it, it's you, as in players wise, it'll be somewhere between 35, 40 players.
Yep.
And then you've got staff after that. But you're against millions of people in that country.
And that's the one they want. Absolutely. Yeah. That's the one they want on their
CV. Because obviously the Lions only come round to New Zealand, South Africa and Australia once every 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years.
So we're lucky enough to do it once every 4 years, and that's a tough enough ask.
Yep.
In that regard, to get selected. But to do that 12 years later is pretty special. So it's as I said, you need good people. You need people that are prepared to dig in, work hard, but not only work hard for themselves, work hard for their teammates.
Because they're going to be a water carrier on a Wednesday or a weekend.
Exactly.
And they're going to get an injury.
Yeah. You're going to get an opportunity. You're going to get a chance. And the whole thing about it is you can't be negative. You can't be selfish about it, because it's not about you. It's about the squad, really. It's not the team. It's the squad. And if you start, and it sometimes does happen. Like you get a couple of players who don't really buy into the Lions ethos. Yeah. They find it quite hard because they're a little bit like you said, they're a big fish in England or Scotland or Ireland or Wales.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden they're a bit of a smaller fish. Oh, don't really like this. And they do get weeded out pretty quick. And you find guys that buy into it pretty quickly. But that's the coach's job. The head coach and his coaches have got to select people that they believe can do this.
Yeah.
And you can accommodate a superstar that is a little bit selfish and just
some things you can put up with,
but you can't do many of them. Right. Not in that aspect, you can't.
Well, it works from a fan's point of view. You know, I get absolutely captivated with it. You know, I'll go to the autumn internationals, and you know, and it's, you know, big England, but that comes around. It captivates you. Every 4 years, it really does.
I've got to say, it does for the fans, but it does for the players as well. It's one of these ones that the Lions, as a brand, even in this professional world, I know for a fact, well, with the last group of players, especially in 2021, which was COVID in that regard, I was chairman that year. I know for a fact, if we had to turn around and say to those players, it's a professional sport now, so they've got to be they've got to be paid in that aspect. And we was, again, able to do that. But let's just say the money wasn't there. That those group of players would have gone, it's not a problem,
we're still coming.
We'll still go.
Yeah.
That's what the British and Irish Lions means to the players. Because for me... And everyone's a little bit different, actually. I spoke to someone the other day saying what it meant to me, and someone went, well, I never thought of that before, Jess. Because I used to, you'd get the jersey, the shirt, and I used to play one or three. I was lucky enough to play both sides of the front row. And I'd always want to make sure that I never let the legend that had played in that shirt before me, never let them down. And I'd say, number one, you had... Loads. Look, you had Frank Cotton. You had from England. You had Mighty Mouse from Scotland. Number three, you had Di Young was one that was just. I actually toured him a couple of times, but he was before me. Graham Price from Wales.
Well, but what you said is really quite emotional words, isn't it?
It is.
I don't want to let the legend that wore that before.
Yeah.
And I think that's lovely.
And I hope in a few years' time, whoever's picking that shirt up might say, I remember Jason Leonard wearing this.
Well, if I was, and I'm not, fortunate enough to pick up your shirt, I'd make sure I played well because I'd be scared what you'd do to me if I didn't. I want to talk on to briefly to England. 2003 World Cup. Your second final?
Second final, yeah. Yeah, against the same opposition.
Did you believe you were going to win the tournament at the start?
Yeah, very much so. And when I say that, that's not an arrogant thing to say. It actually was born out of the results. We had beaten everybody, home and away, for the best part of 18 months leading up to that World Cup. So we were confident. In no way, shape or form was we arrogant about it. But we'd learned over a number of years how to win close games, edge games out and stuff like that. And people will always think about 2003, obviously the glory of winning a World Cup. But we lost games before that, important games, Grand Slam games.
Yep.
But the one thing that was exceptional about that group of players is we never made the same mistake twice. So when we got into the World Cup, it was a case of, right, here we go. No one was talking about final, no one was talking about getting in the knockout stages. It was just game by game. And that's how we did it. And I've got to say, I don't think we really played well. We had bits and pieces. We had big scores. And we beat South Africa very early on in the tournament. But again, we felt that we weren't playing as well as we possibly could. Our best game was most probably the semi-final against France.
Which I think was you became the record cap holder at that point, didn't you?
I think I was, yeah. Yeah, but that was our best performance. And actually, even going into the final, we didn't play that well. They showed some clips of it a little while ago. And us as players were actually going, God, I don't remember that. Because you get the sense we were all over Australia, but we just kept on letting them back in the game. And our discipline wasn't as good as what it was during the tournament and stuff like that. So we only had ourselves to blame, really, in that regard. But did we ever think we was going to lose it? No, not at all.
In the final, I mean, I think I'm right in saying you played all seven games. You came off the bench. I've read and I've been told by other people it was you coming on was a vital substitution. Did Clive? I mean, there's lots of stories about what Clive did do, didn't do. Did somebody get hold of you and say, right, Jason, this is what was specifically vital about that? If you see it that way,
I'd been saying to the management, because you can pick up the ref sort of links, something like that. I was just listening to the referee as the game was progressing, and he was getting more and more pissed off with us. And this guy is a referee that is a good ref, Andre Watson. He's a yes sir, no sir, three bags full ref. He's one of those guys that you just can't argue with him, and you just can't get on the wrong side of him. And we were doing that all the time in the second half, for whatever reason. And I think it got about 20 minutes to go, and it was the referee's language that sort of sparked me, because obviously we were killing Australia in the scrums, and he told us beforehand that he was going to allow us, even though it was a World Cup final, big stage, and you want it to be a great celebration of rugby. But if you want to spend all day scrummaging Australia off the park, go do it, guys. Go do it. He actually even said, I'm South African. Like, I love the scrummage. Go do it, and all this. We duly went and did that, and then we started getting penalised for it. But again, we wasn't listening to the referee. I suppose because we were in a final, it's very emotive. So I think our emotions
got the better. If it was just a test match, it's not a normal game anyway. Yeah. But it was the elite of the elite.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case, that because it was a final, we tried to bludgeon them in the scrums, and if we'd been listening to the referee, all the referee wanted was two or three very nice, tidy scrums. The ball comes in, the ball goes out, and he'd go, great, lovely. And then all of a sudden, we could have pushed Australia all the way down the park.
So you're telling me you got brought on to be nice?
To a certain degree, I don't think anyone can say that I was brought on to be nice. I think the reason was there was a disconnect with our front row.
Needed to change.
And the referee. And I've been having a go at Clive and the other coaches saying, get me on. And at that time, we're winning. So you can see the reason why Clive's going,
why do I want to change? I don't need
to bring Jason on at the moment. I don't need to bring Jason on at the moment. Of course, then the last penalty of the match, we give away a penalty in the scrummage. He kicks it, the Australian lad. All of a sudden, it's a draw. Now we're going into extra time. So literally, Clive comes on the pitch and says, right, Jase, you're on. And I said, right, not a problem. I went over to Martin Johnson, and I just said, Jono, look, we're not pushing in the scrums. And Jono's looking at me and goes, oh, really? And I went, mate, I'm playing against a guy called Matt Dunning. I said, my grandmother could have pushed Matt Dunning in that regard. I said, but look, the referee wants neat and tidy scrums. So let them win their ball, we'll win ours. I turned around to Neil Back, one of the best open-side flankers that England have ever produced, and said, Backy, are these mob ever going to score a try from the base head of scrum, really, from the back of the scrum? And I think Neil Back come back with saying, over my dead body. I think that's good enough for me, sort of thing like that. And then I went and sought out the referee. And as I said, Andre Watson is a solid referee, but you've got to approach him.
You know what he likes, you know what he doesn't like.
And I just said, excuse me, sir. And he sees me. I said, look, you know me. I'll go forwards and I'll go backwards. I don't go up and I don't go down. So you're going to get no penalties out of me. And he actually said something like, thank you, Jase. Again, it was the language he wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the scrums were neat and tidy. We were winning our ball. They were winning their ball. And we must have had, I don't know, half a dozen scrums. And in the second half of extra time, I run past Andre Watson. And as I said, because he's of a type that if I was to, in the small of his back, go, excuse me, sir, he would literally physically recall. I said, what are you doing? What are you touching me for? Something like that. So I literally went like that without touching him. I went, excuse me, sir. Everything all right with the scrums? Do you want me to change anything? And he just looked at me and went, Jason, everything is absolutely fantastic. Thank you. And I was like, that's it. So, I'd always say I was one of a number of things. We had such a great squad. Other people come on the pitch as well that made a difference. Mike Catt, Lewis Moody also come on the pitch. But I suppose to a certain degree, my job was to most probably try and create a reset in that regard. And that's what we did. And it allowed us to get back in the game because we wasn't giving away penalties at scrums. We were still giving away penalties, but not at scrums.
Not at scrums. Well, I'm glad you came on. I'm glad that there was a bloke called Johnny somewhere that was behind you.
So was we.
It's amazing that we won it. I know you played a little bit after that, but who was the best rugby player? It's two for you. The best you played with and the best you played against. And I know that's difficult because there's lots of different positions that make a game of rugby up.
I think it's very hard to say best player with, but only because there's so many. I think best player that I've played against, again, there's so many, but there is one. There's one that's such an outstanding player, sadly no longer with us, was Jonah Loma.
Oh, he was unreal, wasn't he?
He was ahead of his time. You see professional rugby players now and the size of them, and they are bigger than when I first started playing. But there's still no one out there that was the size of Jonah. I mean, Jonah was a 6'5" left wing.
Quick.
Yeah, could do the 100 metres over, like literally in 11 seconds in his socks. Weighed about 19 and a half stone. And even now, I don't think there's anyone in world rugby as big as him, no, as a winger. And the mayhem he used to create, because he was not just big and fast, he could move, he could run.
Left, right.
And then again, they had such a talented team at the time, the All Blacks. He was a great decoy runner, so he made everyone else
free went that way, and somebody else just walked through the other bit.
So, I mean, I think it's tough to say who regarding playing with, but playing against, there's only one person, and that's Jonah Loma.
You miss playing?
I think you do miss the game itself, but I think you're pretty realistic. When you stand there, national anthems, you see the players run out on the pitch, your enthusiasm's there for all of about 30 seconds, and then it's like, no.
Yeah, once the national anthem finishes, game. You think, I'll sit down there.
So you see the first collision, you're like, oh, my God, that. I think what it is you miss is you miss the camaraderie.
Your brothers.
Of the changing room. That's what you miss.
I get that.
That's the games, okay. Like the training, not a problem missing that. It's the people that you're out on the pitch with. And it's a very hard thing to say because we can take it to a whole different level because I never thought of it like this, but rugby is a contact sport. Injuries can happen. But if you've got people that, as part of the team, that are trying to help you and making sure they're protecting you and stuff like that, that's absolutely fantastic. That's the team you want to be in. But you're also mates as well.
Yeah.
Because you do, as you say, you there's big hits in rugby and you want massive. Someone behind you. You need someone going, look, don't you take that. I'll do this next time and stuff like that. Or even in a scrummage, look, you take a rest. I'll do this. And that's what the sport's all about.
And it builds that friendship back, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy, I remember you becoming the president of the RFU. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, very much so. I'd say it nearly killed me in many aspects. Because
socialising?
Yeah, it was, which was brilliant, which was absolutely great. But you could be out every day of the week,
yeah,
really, in that regard. And you're out every weekend. And
takes a toll on your life, it personally, does for your body.
It does, yeah, it does.
It's hard graft, isn't it?
You basically take a year out of work in that aspect, really. Take a year off and you're not really... You're working a part-time week, really. But it's great because, again, you're going to places where... It's all great when you're at England or Harlequins or down at Bath and all that. It's wonderful.
It's not so good when you're going up north or across overseas, Scotland, Ireland. Exactly.
You want to go somewhere else. You want to go somewhere where they're... Some clubs don't have.
So you learnt your lesson then, because then you became chairman of the British and Irish Lions.
I suppose to a certain degree I'm glutton for punishment in that regard. But the beauty of it for me was it's the breadth of the game. It's, again, as I said, it's lovely at the top end. I most probably had more joy and more fun going to smaller clubs. Clubs that don't even have a clubhouse.
Yeah,
they get changed in a pub, and then they trot out onto a local.
I like the idea of the pub as well.
Yeah, but there you have the club president's lunch there and stuff like that. And you'd go somewhere where actually one of the clubs literally was in the process of refurbing their clubhouse shares. So people, you had buckets and stuff like that. I mean, you couldn't make it up.
That's great, isn't it?
But you're there going, that's what this game about is all about. It's not just it's not just the elite. It's just not just the top end. It's from top to bottom in that regard.
Talking about top to bottom, talking about rugby, what shape is rugby in? I mean, if anyone's going to know, I'm not saying you know the answer, but is it in good shape at the moment? Has it got a tough time ahead?
I suppose to a certain degree, as a sport... Of recent years, we have sort of lurched from one issue to another and stuff like that. I think a lot of people in the game are doing the right thing for the right reasons in that aspect. I think there can always be more support. Everyone, and I don't know if that's come up with some of your other people, some people think support is just the hand is out and, or just give me money. Well, you can't give everyone money in that aspect. So it's how can we help you another way? And again, helping young people stay in the game, boys and girls, because sometimes we're seeing that boys and girls go off to university and then they'll play rugby there. But back in our day, we used to go to uni, come back, or once you finish uni, come back. Some of these players are not coming back. So it's, whilst we're not in a
it is a challenge.
Place, yeah.
I see it. I'm a vice president at Chesant, and we see that. We see people, you know, great that they're going to uni, but we might lose them. And it is boys and girls. We've got a great ladies and girls section at the club, and it is booming there. But I hear these stories. Yeah. I see, you know, we've had the problems of a few professional clubs going to the wall.
Yeah.
I saw something the other day that came out, and it intrigued me because, you know full well I'm a big football fan. That they're looking to introduce, I just like your opinion, looking to reduce weigh-ins to try and create. Now, I go to the Stoop. I think it's an amazing atmosphere. What I love about rugby, I can turn up in a Quinn shirt or a Quinn scarf and go anywhere and feel safe. I certainly can't do that at a game of football. No. But equally, there is a tribal atmosphere you get at football. What do you think about introducing a weigh-ins in the world of rugby?
I've got to say, it only came out the other day, didn't it? So I think it'd be worth a try. I mean, again, I wouldn't say it's perfect in some aspects because I do always remember laughing that one of my first games at Twickenham in the very early days of mobile phones, and we're playing France. And, of course, where I grew up, obviously down the road, all my mob are West Ham. So I brought a load of my lot along to watch a game against France. And obviously you just turn your phone off. You don't obviously want that ringing and stuff like that before the game, so you just throw that into your locker. And play the game against France. We win, get in the change room afterwards. as you can imagine, everyone's bouncing, jumping about, over the moon and all this. All of a sudden, I turn on my phone, and of course, it's beep, 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 beep. I've got texts on the on one of those old Nokia phones and all this. So beep, 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 beep. And also, one of my mates is texting me, and he's like, good luck today, Jason, on this. And one of the guys I've invited, there's about three or four of them. And then all of a sudden, the next text is, mate, what have you done? You've only got us tickets in the away end. And I'm like, there is no away end, you idiot. What are you talking about? And then the next text is, we're sitting next to a group of Frenchies. And this is only going to end badly. And then the next text...
I can see that coming from West Ham fans.
And then the next text is, we're having a few ports and brandies with these Frenchies. And then the next text is, they're actually not that bad. And I'm like, you idiots, this is not football. It's not football. So there's an element of it. I can see whoever's sort of been behind this to create that atmosphere.
Yep.
It maybe improve the atmosphere in that regard. I think there's got to be a fine line, because the one thing about rugby is the values of rugby. And I think we've just got to be careful if you're going to have, obviously in the mixing as well, is alcohol. You don't want to give people the excuse to then start misbehaving, maybe using some language that, again, could well be appropriate at a football match, but it don't mean it's appropriate at a rugby match where you've got young people around you and stuff like that. And I remember speaking to someone once, avid football fan, and very well-to-do guy, business and stuff like that, and meek as anything. Get him in the stand, the language that he uses, and I sort of said... And I remember saying to him once, like, really? I mean, and he said, like, he goes, I pay my season ticket and I'm allowed to say what I like. And I'm going...
I think there's some people feel like that, sadly.
Yeah, and I don't want that. So, again, whilst if this is to be trialled and used, we've also then got to look at the negatives out of it and make sure we nip that in the bud as well. Because I'm all for making it a little bit more noisy. I'm all for making it a little bit more... Again, at rugby, it's more banter in that aspect.
It is banter, absolutely.
You go to soccer, there's some things being said where you're like, whoa, hold on, sort of thing like that. We've got to make sure that that doesn't happen. And the problem is, if you've just got a group of one team of supporters there and they're not being supervised and looked at, just sort of lobbed in there and they're drinking and they're this and that, you don't want to go down that path where there's so many things I think rugby has learnt from football in the past about how the game's turned pro and stuff like that. There's also a lot of negatives in football
for sure
that we've gone, right, we don't need that, push that to one side. This will be one of those that was like that. Now it's come back. Again, let's give it a try, but I think we've got to keep an eye on it and make sure that whoever's involved in like as we said, like an away end or whatever it would be, that it's
done
their behaviour's done properly.
I think it's a good answer. I want to move you away from rugby. You're enjoying your time at Besso still?
Yeah. No, so we've been absorbed by another company now, a larger company. So it's great for us. I think we've got 14,000 staff now and 100 odd offices around the world. So yeah,
no, you, still does that mean it. You're going to do a bit more travelling?
Yeah, I'm trying not to do more travelling, but that's proving not to be the case at this moment in time. But it'll calm down in a certain amount of time. But no, still loving it. The people we work with, it's very similar to the rugby. It's teams. It's the closest thing, in a bizarre way, to being in a rugby team where you've got people who've got your back in that regard. And I can ask people in my teams, look, I need you to do this, I need you to do that, and they'll go out and they'll do it for me, and hopefully they know if they turn around to me and say, oh Jason, I need this, I need it, I'm on it, I'll try and get that done for you, something like that.
The one thing I do know, knowing you for the number of years I've known you, you've got great nature. I class you as a gentle giant. I know you're a great giver up for charity. I think when I first really got to meet you was at a charity event. I know you give your time up for charity, but you've got a charity that's close to your heart. Do you want to tell us about that, Atlas?
So, the Atlas Foundation, I started because it was born out of frustration, really, because in some of the most beautiful places in the world, we play rugby. Cape Town, for example. Buenos Aires in Argentina. But you come out of the the airport or you come out of the stadium and there's a shanty town next door. And the poverty that's there is on a whole different level in that regard. And so I kicked it around with a few people and I said, look, and at the time I was doing charity dinners anyway. And I said, well, look, someone said, well, why don't you start up your own charity? So we did that, and the charity's been now going since 2015, something like that. But we help kids in slums around the world, and we've mostly been in, I think, 19 countries. We're over 200,000 kids that we've been helping. Really? And again, it's 50-50, boys, girls. So that's a big thing that we want to make sure it's evenly split. We use rugby as the hook, but it's the values of rugby that we use. So, again, we run training sessions during the week, more than likely on a Sunday. We use one of the local rugby clubs, wherever it would be, so they've got the facilities. Of course, these kids come in and they're wearing rags, and then we give them kit and boots. Some of these kids are walking around, they've obviously got no trainers, no
gives values, doesn't it?
And then they have a load of fun. Yeah, a load of fun. And it's about giving them an experience and getting them out of there. They've just spent 2-3 hours having fun with their peers rather than they could have spent 2-3 hours at home in absolute poverty, or actually, even worse, hanging around on street corners, causing trouble.
That doesn't end well, does it?
No. And so we use rugby as the hook to get them there. And then once rugby's finished, we'll use the facilities. So most of these kids don't have running water in their houses in that aspect. So they'll use a local river or whatever it would be, or hot showers. And they're like, oh my God, they'll stay in the showers all day. You've got to try and get them out. So we'll go out, something like that. But then we'll put on food from as well. It's most probably the best meal of the week that some of these kids will have, because the old man might have scarpered, or he might have passed away. Mum's maybe working 3-4 jobs in that regard. They might be looked after by their grandparents and this and that. Yep. And it just gives them the excuse to find themselves in a safe environment, a safe haven in that regard. And if that wasn't there, as I said, what they're going to do is they're going to join a gang, get into trouble, start taking drugs. All of a sudden, one of them has a knife, then they rob someone. All of a sudden, it creates a world of problems. And everybody wants to be part of a family. Everyone wants to be part of a team. And what we're saying is, no matter where we are around the world, is be part of our team. Don't be part of their team, the kids that are nicking and stealing and stabbing and robbing or whatever it is. Yep. Come and be part of our team. And we have got all our programs through education, obviously, health. That's what we do. And hopefully create an opportunity that kids can not only survive, but they can thrive.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to have been a few of your do's. I know we have a very small thing we did this year for you. Keep going. Keep up with the good work.
Oh,
I know you get great support, but keep it going. When we sat down, I think I said to you that time goes quickly. It's flown by. I have got the pleasure of carrying on talking to you later, because we're going to go out and have something to eat and probably a beer or two. I've really enjoyed your company, mate.
I loved it.
For me, it's an honour to call you a friend. I always just enjoy being around you. Thank you for your time.
No, mate.
Appreciate it greatly. Can't reach with
cheers. Getting old.
Viewers, listeners, I think when we sat down, I said rugby royalty. I think that's right. He is a lovely human being. He's a top bloke. I've really enjoyed it. I'm sure you're going to enjoy the listeners too. Take care. Stay safe. See you soon.